Today's show is brought to you by School Spirit Vending. School Spirit Vending has a hassle-free, year-round fundraising program for schools. You can learn more at schoolspiritvending.com.
Welcome to the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast, where school leaders go to find inspiration and learn world-class strategies from top influencers in education. Better Leaders, Better Schools was created by Daniel Bauer.
In today's show, I talk with David Allen, and we discuss what it means to have a career in opportunity, how to identify your key priorities, the power of a listening tour, and the two questions every school leader needs to ask. I don't take for granted that you're listening to this show. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy it. Well, hey, Better Leaders, I'm excited to connect today with David Allen. David brings to Oliver over 15 years of experience working in the field of educational access for high-achieving students. He previously served as Director of Education at New Jersey Seeds, where he oversaw programs serving 750 students. He's the author of four books and dozens of articles, and has taught at Princeton University and has served as a visiting scholar at Columbia University. David holds a BA from Brown and a PhD from Harvard. His daughter, Jordan, is a graduate of Packer Collegiate. He has spoken at many national conferences, including the annual meeting of the College Board Forum, the Association of Boarding Schools, the National Partnership for Educational Access, and the National Association of College Admissions Counselors. He serves on the board of the National Association of Independent Schools and is currently a visiting scholar at the New School. David, thank you so much for joining me on the show.
Thank you, Daniel, for having me.
Hey, we made it. So we had a few bugs, listeners, in the beginning there, but we've persevered, and now we're bringing you a high-quality show. David, let's start with what inspired you to pursue a career in education?
Well, it's funny, because first of all, I don't really think of myself right now as having a career in education. I think of it more as having a career in opportunity.
I like that. Yeah.
My job as the CEO of Oliver is to provide opportunity for highly motivated, high-achieving Black and Latino students. And most simply, that means the opportunity to go to great schools and to be well-prepared for them. But it can also mean the opportunity to intern at a prestigious law firm.
Yeah.
Or the opportunity to give back themselves. That said, I think if you care about society, you care about education. Education is how a society takes care of its young and its future.
Right.
And you can make a difference through art or through politics or through education. So you can't care about the future without caring about education.
No, absolutely. Help me understand, though, connect the dots. Like, how'd you get passionate about this idea of opportunity and this idea of access, particularly for students of color? It makes sense, this idea of education and how that, right, is so important for our future and our kids and the foundation it builds in our society. But not everybody gets that question about access, and it's so important. So how did the bug bite you, or why is this an important calling for you?
Well, I think it began for me. I had the privilege of going to a really extraordinary school, an independent school in Washington, D.C. when I was growing up. It's called Georgetown Day. And it was a school that was deeply committed to diversity and equity and justice. And we were really encouraged as students to see ourselves as members of a society and to ask how we could serve the greater good. And one thing that just struck me was, there's just no reason in the world that I or anybody else should have more opportunity simply because of, our parents or wealth or how, what we were born into. Mm-hmm. Circumstances shouldn't be dictating that. Later on, I was going to be a historian.
Okay.
And I was teaching at Princeton, and my field that I had written about was about the so-called sexual revolution of the 1960s. That's what I did my dissertation on.
Yeah.
And so I was going to teach a course on that. And Princeton at the time was not ready for that course.
They weren't ready. No.
They were not ready. And they came back to me and they said, please come up with something else.
Right.
So I came up with a course on the history of and philosophy of educational reform. And it was teaching that course that got me motivated to find out what was happening outside the academy, outside higher education. And I realized I wasn't ready to be a historian focused exclusively on the past. I wanted to be engaged with the present and with the future.
Yeah.
And that's when I moved into the nonprofit sector.
And were there things at this at the school, I think you said in D.C., was that correct?
That's correct, yes.
So you found yourself there at this independent school. Was it the coursework that shaped this mindset of access and of equity and opportunity? Were there certain activities that you all participated in? Was it the actual student body that they formed? You know, what was it that influenced you there?
It was a very, very special school, and the commitment to diversity and equity and social justice was very deep, from making sure there was financial aid available for low-income students and for students of color in particular, making sure the faculty was diverse. I had Black teachers from a very young age who were very important and influential for me and who I really looked up to and admired.
Yeah.
I had a teacher, her name was Gloria Runyon, for instance. She was my second grade teacher, and I just adored her. And she made me feel good about myself, even though I was dealing with a lot of difficult stuff at home. My parents were getting divorced, and around her, I felt safe and secure and capable and competent. And she went on to be the head of the lower school. And it wasn't just a school only about warm feelings. In the upper school, it was a very academically intensive environment, but it was a school where we were taught very, very, in every aspect of the school, the notion of mutual respect and appreciation for one another. And for instance, we called our teachers by their first names.
Okay.
And it wasn't that we were friends with our teachers. Our teachers were way above us. Like, we admired them, but it was a kind of a world of trust that the teachers were going to, they could trust that we would value them and appreciate them without kind of, you know, needing to hide behind anything. They could be themselves with us. It was a very profound experience.
Yeah, it sounds incredible. You called that neutral respect?
Mutual. No, mutual.
I'm sorry.
Mutual.
So
yeah, no, that's fine.
We're inventing a whole new term. I'm like,
No. Just
you heard it like first that on the show.
I love inventing terms, but that one's just mutual respect.
Mutual respect. All right, I've heard of that one. Thank you, David. Oh, that's so good. Was that odd for you to call teachers by their first name and have that type of relationship at first? Or was it pretty easy to, get used to, I guess?
It wasn't odd at all, because I started at that school in kindergarten.
Oh.
And when you start somewhere in kindergarten, you don't have any preset notions of how the world is supposed to be.
Oh, my.
My daughter, you know, recently graduated. She's in college now, but when she was in high school, it was still very hard for me to accept that she would call her teachers Mr. and Mrs.
Right. That was a more traditional. It's harder to adjust to that, huh?
Yeah.
Very interesting. David, in your role as the CEO now, how would you describe your leadership style, and how'd you develop it?
I don't know exactly how I would describe it. I mean, I think, you know, like I said, I was very influenced by the culture, the leadership culture at Georgetown Day, and that sense of mutual respect. I was very influenced as a leader by Ted Sizer at Brown. So Sizer, probably most of your listeners have some familiarity with Sizer. He was a very influential writer and thinker on education. And he was one of those rare academics who's not just smart, but he was also very wise.
Yeah.
He was wise about life and about people. And his books on the American public school they're imbued with a generosity of spirit.
Mm.
And he believed strongly that the best teachers, in other words, the best leaders, should be like coaches. The job is to point to the goal and help you reach it.
Yep.
And I got into an argument with him once because I hated sports and I had never gotten better at any sport. And I said, so that's a terrible metaphor. And he said, no, you just never had a good coach. And he was right. I never did. So I always think of myself as a coach first. But, you know, at GDS, we were deeply influenced, again, just to go back to that, you know, those formative years, I think, are just so crucial. And we studied the civil rights movement in depth, and that just had a very profound influence on me as a person and as a leader.
Okay. So I've asked you some easy questions. You know, we're talking a little bit about the history and I didn't realize it, but K through, you know, the whole experience in DC there. But what would you consider your worst leadership mistake, and what did you learn from it?
Oh, I have made so many leadership mistakes. I definitely made a mistake. I got to the last organization I worked at. I got there and I was new and fresh and excited, but there were things that didn't make any sense to me. And I said, well, let's just change them. And I started just changing things. And it never even occurred to me that there were people who had invested time and thought in developing things the way they were, and that they might feel attached to things the way they were. And, you know, I was just this self-righteous person who wasn't, I was just in my own little world. So that was a definite leadership mistake there.
I think I've made that mistake myself as a new principal, not necessarily changing all the systems or changing different aspects of the culture, but maybe not investigating quite enough why they do the things they do.
Right.
And so even without the change, it disrespected, I guess, their identity to some level because I didn't put in that type of work. Do you have any tips for our listeners in terms of how to balance their new, fresh, and excited outlook within an organization, but still understanding the rich history, the culture that they find themselves in, and show that mutual respect to bring it all back?
Well, I think that part of that is being very clear when you start out. What are your key priorities? What do you want to make sure that you accomplish? And I don't think that there are right or wrong priorities, but you have to have priorities and you have to be clear about them. Mm-hmm. So if your priority is like getting to know every student in the school, great. Or if your priority is getting to know every faculty member, great. Or if your priority is getting to know the schedule and figuring out what works about the schedule and doesn't work about the schedule, great. Whatever it is, there isn't a right or wrong priority, but being clear about your priorities. And you're going to have to course adjust at some point. Somebody's going to say, you know, it's great that you know all the students, but we need you to know what the schedule is and think about the schedule. And that's fine. And then you'll course correct at that point. But you can't try to tackle everything at once. And if you do, that's, I think, when you get yourself in trouble.
Do you have some type of mental model or framework that helps you identify what that top priority or top three should be?
Well, I think that comes from doing some research before you even walk in the door. And knowing, doing some talking to people, you know, the classic people call it a listening tour, right? Where you're just talking to people and you're finding out what's kind of the general consensus of what's working and what's not working. What do you want to bring to the party, so to speak?
When you took over Oliver Scholars, I'm sure you went on some type of listening tour, but if that's correct, what did you learn about the organization and how did that help motivate where you wanted to bring it?
Well, there were things about Oliver I was very excited by. I was very excited by the fact that this was an organization where all the kids were from New York City. And that meant that we could do a lot where we could provide a lot for kids during breaks and during the summer. And we could really be taking full advantage of the city in a way that I had been in an organization that was a statewide organization where it was very hard to bring kids together. So that was the one thing that really excited me about it. And then I saw opportunities, having worked other places and coming, I saw opportunities that I knew would benefit current students and future students. And so I made it my goal to develop those opportunities. And then it's a nonprofit. And as a nonprofit, funding is always a key priority. And part of my job really was to identify how am I going to strengthen the fundraising capacity of the organization. That was a big part of my role.
I'm just curious. I have a lot of friends in nonprofits and don't necessarily do this, you know, obviously the same exact work that you all do, but I'm just curious what you've learned about funding and making sure that these kids have access to these incredible opportunities that are provided through Oliver Scholars. What have you learned about raising funding for your nonprofit?
Well, one thing is it's all in the details. You have to be incredibly detail oriented when you're raising money. You have to pay attention to the smallest of smallest things because people care. You know, they care about the details. And if you miss out on something small, that can really turn someone off. And you also have to be, you have to set big goals, and you have to be asking all the time for money, politely, with a smile, gently, yeah. But you have to be asking, you have to be asking all the time.
Yeah.
And getting the right people in front of potential donors. And for us, the nice part is that our kids are just so inspiring.
Yes.
And so when people meet the students, they want to give. That makes our job easier.
Mm.
So my job is to really get people in front of the students.
And in terms of this current school year, what are you most particularly proud of in terms of what Oliver Scholars has accomplished?
Well, I'm very proud. I mean, the students, as I said, they go to incredible schools. Our track record, we have over 1,000 alumni, and it's not a great metric for a lot of reasons. It's a flawed metric, but it is a metric that people understand, which is that on average, 30% of our students go to Ivy League schools, which is a pretty, incredible number. What I'm particularly proud of is that we have, in the two and a half years that I've been at Oliver, we've expanded our programming significantly in terms of what students, before I got there, students had classes in the summers before high school. And now they have classes in the summers, but they also have classes throughout eighth grade on weekends and after school. And part of that was asking students, would you like to have classes? Would you like to have more Oliver classes? And they said, absolutely. And I said, would it conflict with anything? And they were like, no, we don't have anything else to do. We'd love to do that. And so I was really excited about that. And so we really made our curriculum more robust throughout eighth grade. And we've added programming for our high school students throughout the 4 years of high school, and we'll continue to do that. And we've added programming for our college students, and we'll continue to do that as well.
Switching gears a little bit, I really enjoyed hearing about Oliver Scholars. In terms of your leadership, tactical, like day-to-day type stuff, what does your first hour of your day look like? Do you have any type of morning routine or ritual that helps you be successful?
I find that in the morning, I really enjoy mornings. I find that I'm the most verbal and creative in the mornings. So I try to use that first hour when I wake up to, if there's anything I need to write, to just sit down at my computer with a cup of coffee. And I love the silence of the morning and the simple sounds, whether that's the coffee in the coffee maker or the heat in the pipes or the clicking of the keyboard. I love it. I love it all.
I like that too. I mean, it sounds like just being present in the moment, right? You hear that coffee, the click of the keyboard. That got me
yeah,
laughing.
It's great. I love it.
Yeah. It sort of builds this momentum. You know, you're being creative. This is your best time to work. And you're just getting excited about that. I love it. In terms of the work you do at Oliver Scholars, what would you like to say to current school leaders in terms of how they support students and how they can support maybe you and your organization as well?
Well, they can write a check. But one of the great things about running a nonprofit is that you can make a difference for every single person on the planet by being an opportunity to contribute. So anybody can make a difference by contributing to Oliver Scholars, and every single person. You can be anywhere on the planet, and you can make a difference by writing a check to Oliver Scholars or to another access organization. Our students primarily go to independent schools for high school. And so part of our mission is to help independent schools be places where our students will thrive. For public schools, it's a little bit different. The questions are different, but I think school leaders can, if there's a lot of socioeconomic diversity in the school, I think being mindful of that and looking for ways. I do wish that public schools and independent schools talk to each other more.
Yeah.
I think there's really interesting stuff happening in both sectors, and they can get very siloed. I think there's a real opportunity for dialogue. Independent schools are doing some really amazing stuff around diversity, and I think public schools are doing other cool things around getting kids to know each other and talk to each other. And I think there's a lot of opportunity there for conversation.
Yeah, I think you're right. What do you think it would take to get that conversation started?
Oh, picking up the phone, going to lunch, calling, right. Just calling, a principal or a headmaster in your school district and saying, hey, can we go to coffee? Can we have lunch? And then just you know, asking them for advice on whatever it is you're dealing with and hearing what they have to share and having a conversation.
Yeah, I love this idea. I want to think more about it offline. It's been really neat connecting with you and hearing about your experience and the work you're doing at Oliver Scholars. And in an earlier podcast, I connected with a headmaster of a independent school in Indiana. But to be honest, David, you know, this the world is completely out of my comfort zone. You know, I don't know it at all. And so I think, you know, picking up the phone is the easy thing, but I'm wondering, you know, just wanting to be creative, and I don't know if there's even like starting a conference or something, getting the best thinkers in independent schools and public schools together and sharing. And I wonder what that could look like or serve as a catalyst is.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. I sponsored a panel discussion. I think it was the fall of 2015, I believe. And it was a panel discussion for independent school leaders and charter school leaders. Is there opportunities for dialogue?
Interesting.
Conversation?
Yeah.
But I think we should all be talking to each other. And I think education and educational leaders, it's all going to be in flux. And I was recently at the National Association of Independent Schools conference and heard a speaker talking about some of the technological changes that are coming down the pike. And it really made me think, wow, we are going to have to dramatically rethink what it means to go to school.
Huh.
For instance, one of the things he talked about was the coming of a kind of contact lens that's like Google Glass, but it's just a contact lens. And
yeah.
If you can imagine a classroom of students where they all have a contact lens in and they're looking at Facebook while the teacher's talking, that makes you realize we're going to have to completely we can't have a classroom like that.
Yeah.
It's going to have to be independent study and group work and project-based learning and performance. Otherwise, mm-hmm. education is going to become obsolete.
And the scary thing about that is probably going to be here sooner than later, right?
Yeah, exactly. We have to get past the kind of industrial model of schooling that we inherited and get way more creative about what it means to learn and make sure that what kids are learning, that they feel like it's relevant to them. If they don't think it's relevant to them, school just becomes brutal.
You know, you bring up a good point with this, the traditional model of school and the Industrial Revolution and, you know, the assembly line, all that kind of stuff. And you hear that as a common knock on public education specifically. I could be super naive on this. I assume that independent schools are positioned a little bit better in terms of being agile and adaptive to their kids' needs. But I could be totally wrong. Is that a...
I don't know. I'm not going to weigh in on that.
Okay.
I'll just say, I think we all need to be about 1,000 times more agile than we currently are.
Mm.
And one of the stops to that right now is college admissions. The colleges need to give up their view of the way to do admissions based on test scores. And it's too limiting and too confining, but they face, it's a complicated machine because financially for them, they have a lot of incentives to keep things exactly the way they are, but
right.
It's all going to shift or else it's all going to become irrelevant.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. We'll see it in our lifetime, I feel like, for sure.
I think we will, yeah.
Today's show is brought to you by School Spirit Vending. School Spirit Vending has a hassle-free, year-round fundraising program for schools. And believe it or not, their CEO and founder, Matt Miller, was a guest on Episode 5 of the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast. He can increase your school spirit with custom stickers for your school and raise funds at the same time. There's no upfront costs, no volunteers, no selling. It's absolutely free to you, the school. If you're sick of the same old ways of raising money, check out School Spirit Vending at schoolspiritvending.com. Speaking of like college admissions and classes that I guess that are important for kids to experience prior to their post-secondary experience themselves, what's one class that you think we should add to our schools that isn't currently taught that you know of?
I would add the course called Why School. And I wouldn't teach it with any answers.
I love that.
I would teach it in a way that allows students to really explore the question for themselves. And I would make it mandatory for all the faculty. Because people have to be actively engaged in the question, why am I doing what I'm doing in order to be fully alive? So when I taught my course on the history and philosophy of education at Princeton, that was the central question of the course. And I tried not to take anything for granted. Hmm. So for instance, the very first day I told the students, it was up to them to figure out what to call me. They could call me Professor Allen or David or whatever they wanted, but it was up to them and they needed to come up with a strong argument for their case. I left the room and I sat outside and I listened in as they debated the alternatives, and it was magical. And by the end of the semester, every student in that class said it had transformed their experience of college.
Wow.
Each one said, this course gave me back my faith in education, that it matters. And I say that's because they were actually grappling with their own education as authors of it,
yeah,
rather than as passive consumers who were simply being told, do this, go here, read this, write that. We put so much emphasis on where education will get you, but it's not actually education if you're not thinking about this moment now and what you're doing now and what's coming out of your mouth right now and why.
That is an incredible activity. What should you call me, students? Am I understanding correctly? Was that something that they had to come to consensus on if they were
debating? They did.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they had to come to consensus, yeah.
How many years did you teach this course?
I was at Princeton for 3 years. I only got to teach that once. I taught it one semester.
Oh, shoot. So I was going to ask, like, you know, well, I want to know what they decided, but I really wanted to know, like, how often did they decide, you know, X, Y, or Z?
That's funny. They decided on Dr. A.
Dr. A.
And I don't remember what the reasoning was, but it made sense at the time. Dr. A.
Why not? Okay, I love it. Dr. A. That's good stuff. Well, Dr. A, when you think of the word leader, who's the first person that comes to mind?
Three people come to mind: Martin Luther King Jr., Gloria Steinem, and Harvey Milk. And they are three people who said, this is where I'm going. You should come with me. And we got to do it now. Time is running out. And are they just profoundly inspiring to me?
Mm. What do you consider one book every principal should read right now and why?
Oh, I said three leaders. I'm going to have to say a couple books too, I think.
No problem.
So one book is Susan Cain's Quiet, about the importance of introversion. I don't agree with everything she says. I don't believe that introversion is genetic or something like that. But I do think that we need to appreciate the value of introspection and introversion. Mm-hmm. And kids who are introverted, we need to help them to come out of their shells so that, because they have, as she points out, they have the potential to be the very best leaders. And kids who are kind of naturally extroverted, we really owe it to them and to ourselves to help them become more reflective and introspective. Right now we have a president who very clearly has done probably no real introspection in his life, and it's just really damaging for our nation and for democracy. Mm. There's a book, a really amazing book by James Carse called Finite and Infinite Games. Carse was a professor at NYU. And what he lays out in Finite and Infinite Games is he looks at how there are games in life that are finite. So winning an award, getting a raise, finding that perfect partner, getting that perfect house, it's all a finite game. And then there are infinite games. And infinite games are love, peace, compassion, empathy, people being their best selves. And those are the games that are really worth playing.
Yeah, where you spend your time focused.
Yeah, yeah. Can I say one more?
Of course you can. You're the guest. Yeah. Listen, this is all about you.
All right. I'm a huge fan of a writer named Jack Kornfield. I don't know if have you ever read him?
Oh, I'm sorry. I actually, I have not read Jack Kornfield. Sorry.
So that's okay. So I love Jack Kornfield. So Jack Kornfield was a Buddhist monk who realized that he needed to find a way to live his Buddhism in the everyday world, specifically the everyday world of contemporary America. You know, it's easy
to challenge.
It's easy to be white light when you're sitting on a mountaintop far away from your family and your neighbors and your coworkers.
In your iPhone.
But he, in his books, and like one of them is called A Path with Heart. In his books, he really helps you to approach life as the Buddha while you're sitting in traffic or while you're dealing with an angry parent. And I think if you believe that you can be a good leader without a strong dose of Buddhism under your belt, I think you're crazy.
It helps a little bit, huh?
Yeah. And it, yeah. keeps you laughing and keeps you sane.
Laughing and sane are both good things. It never hurts to have a really good chuckle. You know, I do the weirdest things. Like, I do love practicing meditation, mindfulness. Yeah, I don't even know why.
Those aren't weird at all.
No,
did you
no.
say those were weird? Those, no.
No, I'm getting to the weird part. It has to do with laughing. I have a beard. I would call it a full beard at this point, a nice big full beard. And I'm 38, so my body's trying to decide if it's still young or if it's like, you know, transitioning to an older man, and my beard wants to be 90% dark brown and about 10% white, and I just want it to be all one or the other. And so I'm really looking forward to the day when it's all white and very full, and I can play like a for real Santa Claus. And so, kind of like you were talking about, just the click clack of your keyboard and the joy that brought you. The idea and being present in the moment and kind of having one foot in the future of thinking of being a for real Santa Claus, I started to just ho, ho, ho in the mirror. And I was going, ho, ho, ho. And it was just cracking me up. You know, it was a cycle of sort of laughter. That's the weird part. So hope the listeners enjoyed that story. David, I hope you enjoyed that.
That's not weird at all. I want you to practice it when you're walking down the street and just say it to people when you're walking down the street.
Why not? You know, and I told a couple of my teachers that too, and they're looking at me like I'm crazy. I'm like, but here's the thing. You just got Christmas in March, and that's awesome.
Exactly. I love that. That's fantastic.
So that's my story. So we had quiet, the finite and infinite gains, and the path with heart, I believe.
Yeah, a path with heart. Yeah,
we'll have that all linked up for the listeners in the show notes as usual, and definitely links to Oliver Scholars as well, so people can, you know, I implore the listeners to really be generous and help them out and you know, just really get behind the great work that they're doing, that David's doing at Oliver Scholars. Just to kind of round down the interview, David, what do you do for fun?
Everything.
Okay.
I mean, I try not to do anything that isn't fun, and I try to have fun doing everything I do. So, I mean, I go to the movies and I watch TV like everyone else, but I've organized my entire life around having fun.
Wow.
What is more fun than leading an educational organization that creates opportunity for kids who work hard?
Yeah.
I mean, I can't think of anything. And I do my best to make sure everyone else around me is having fun too. I mean, I think boring meetings should be outlawed.
Mm-hmm.
I think long speeches should be outlawed. I think you have a moral and ethical obligation to make sure people around you are having fun all the time.
Mm. So how do you do that with also knowing that you can't please everybody?
Well, part of it is keeping things focused, right? Not drifting off into a million different directions. And another part of it is being honest and always telling one on yourself. Because if you're telling one on yourself, then people can laugh with you and feel safe. And it makes things fun. And not trying hard to convince others that you have it all together and that you're good enough, but being relaxed. If you yourself are relaxed, then other people can relax.
David, if you could be automatically good at something, just at the snap of your fingers, what would that be?
Well, I think just to continue in that vein, it would actually being able to put people at ease, because you can't have the really important conversations and do the really meaningful work until people are at ease. And, you know, if I could walk into a room and immediately everybody just felt relaxed and comfortable and happy to be themselves and feel good enough about themselves so that we can then get to like, okay, what's next? What are we going to take on now? That would be just magical.
Yeah, that would be magical. David, what message would you put on all school marquees if you could do that across our nation for one single day?
Life is short and then you die.
You heard it here first, folks.
Because the moment you forget that, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter if you're a principal, a teacher, or a student. The moment you think, you know, you've got endless amounts of time, or, you know, it, or that it's all so significant. Either way, if you go either way, I've got endless amounts of time, so nothing matters, or it's all so significant. If you go in either of those two directions, you're just in trouble.
You're in trouble. Yeah, you're right. David, I'm proud of you. You made it to the end of the interview. This last question, I'm really interested to hear how you're going to answer it. You're building a school from the ground up. I actually, just to cut myself off, I cut this question like, I don't know, 15, 20 episodes ago, and like the fans were outraged. So I brought it back. People love it, and they still love it, I guess. So going back, you're building a school from the ground up. You're not limited by your budget or your resources. Your only limitation is your imagination. How, David, would you build your dream school, and what would be the top three priorities?
Well, like I said before, I think that schools are going to have to change dramatically, and that we're going to really have to create opportunities for individual learning and group work and projects and performance. It's not going to be a classroom in the same way that it ever was. And teachers are really going to have to be coaches and facilitators and dramaturgs. And they're going to have to get out of the way so that students can own their own learning and show it off. And I would want a school that is alive with energy and research and performance and connections to life beyond the school walls. And I guess right now I'm talking more about middle school and high school. When it comes to elementary school, I know a lot less about that. But no matter what, I would want a school where parents walk in and say, oh, this is how life could be. I could make our home more like this. I could make my office more like this. I could make I could do my part to make our whole society more like this. I think if you've done that, you've done your job in creating an environment that is right for students. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. There's so much great stuff to that. I think it'd be super interesting to listen to go back and listen to now. It's, I think I said episode 94 for this show, but go back and listen to all the different responses. I mean, your response, everybody's response is like, they basically blow up my mind every time you share them. And it just makes me, going back to what you said, earlier in the class that you taught at Princeton, why school? It's I love these answers so much. So yes, good job. Today I'm giving you an A.
That's all that matters, right?
Absolutely. Have you ever come across that? Did you ever read The Art of Possibility by any chance?
Absolutely. The Zanders. I love that book.
Yeah.
It's a great book.
I love that. Given an A and the rule number 6, I think are my two favorite.
I don't remember rule number. What's rule number 6?
Okay, let me tell you. So there's a dignitary and a prime minister, right? And in their meeting, they have very, very important business to attend to. And so they have some type of problem. They're looking for a solution. And as they're working, you hear a knock at the door. And the door opens, and it's David's at the door. His hair's a mess. His shirt's untucked. He looks completely disheveled, and he's cursing, the world's on fire. We got a problem. We got to solve it now. And the prime minister calmly looks at David and he says, David, don't forget rule number 6. So David fixes his hair and he tucks his shirt back in. He's no longer screaming about how the rules, the world's going to end and all that. And he says, yes, sir. Walks calmly out the door. Prime minister and the dignitary having very important work to get back to. They get back to solving that problem, trying to figure out some type of resolution when there's another knock at the door. And this time it's Jordan, and her hair's a mess, and her dress is all out of sorts, and she's screaming and cussing, and the world's going to end, and we need a solution now. It's super, super important. And the prime minister turns to Jordan and says, Jordan, don't forget rule number 6. So Jordan calmly collects herself, fixes her hair, that sort of thing. Thank you, sir, and walks out the door. Well, at this point, the dignitary is thinking, what the heck just happened? What is the power of rule number 6 that the prime minister can just say it and everybody, calms down? So, prime minister, what is rule number 6? I just have to know. So the prime minister turns to the dignitary and he says, well, that's quite simple. Rule number 6 is don't take yourself so dang seriously. And that's
there
the,
you go.
That's rule number six. It's not that you can't take the situation, the problem seriously, but it's, you know, you're never giving anything to your organization, to your partner, to your family, anything, if you're taking yourself too seriously. What does that really get you? And so the dignitary asks the prime minister, well, what's rules 1 through 5? And I love this. And the prime minister says, there's no other rules.
That's great. That's great. I love that.
I love that one too. Well, David, thanks so much for being a part of the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast. Do you have any parting words of advice? And what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Well, first of all, thank you for creating the podcast. I think it's fantastic. And I think it's so valuable for educators to have an opportunity to think and reflect on these kinds of really important and essential questions. My parting words of advice would be, don't give advice. I mean, people will rarely take your advice.
Yeah.
And then you'll just be annoyed.
Right.
And advice itself is kind of irritating. when you're having a conversation with someone and you're really engaged in the conversation with them and you're asking each other great questions, you'll both see something that you haven't seen before. You know, it's like a new future, it's filled with new possibilities. Mm-hmm. You talk about the art of possibility.
Yeah.
Those new possibilities will kind of arise. And then the paradox that though is that like, you also shouldn't take my advice that you shouldn't give advice, right?
Because
sometimes you should, right?
Sure.
You know, but you should, I think it's valuable to always ask yourself, why am I giving this advice? What am I really striving for here? What's the future I'm out to create? And I think if you engage with those questions, the advice you give will be richer and more valuable.
Absolutely. Hey, and at the end of the day, life is short, then you die, so.
Exactly. And you know what happens after that?
What?
The really scary part?
What's that?
Everyone looks at each other and says, what's for lunch?
You're awesome, David.
Thank you, man. I really appreciated the opportunity.
Absolutely. Better Leaders, thank you for investing in yourself today by listening to this podcast. Remember that life's 10% of what happens to you and 90% how you react to it. Go out there today and be a better leader. Today's podcast was brought to you by Daniel and David. Be better starting today by heading over to betterleadersbetterschools.com and type David in the search bar. The show notes page will pop up. You'll get highlights of today's episode, links to all the resources, including Oliver Scholars, and the best way to connect. David, thanks again for sharing your leadership insights and helping the better leaders be better.
My privilege. Thank you.
Better Leaders, thank you for joining us on the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast. Visit us at betterleadersbetterschools.com, a blog and podcast made specifically for you to help you meet your leadership potential. Have you gotten value from today's show? Help me reach even more listeners by leaving a 5-star rating and review. Click the podcast artwork and press the Show Some Love link to leave an honest rating and review. A long, long time ago in a galaxy far away, patrons would sponsor artists to create something the patron valued. Would you consider becoming a patron of the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast? If you found this podcast valuable, if the show has pushed your thinking about leadership, and if you've benefited in any way, then I would be honored if you would become a sponsor. Sponsorship is easy. Head over to patreon.com/better or click the link in the show notes to become a patron for as little as $1 a month. If you pledge 10 bucks a month, I'll send you one of my favorite leadership books every other month. That's patreon.com/better or click the link in the show notes. Do you have a question or need some leadership advice? I want to connect with you. I read every email, tweet, snap that's sent to me. Links are in the show notes to connect via email and social media. Better Leaders, Better Schools is a proud member of the Edu Podcast Network, podcast for educators, podcast by educators. You can listen to more great education podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com.